For my wife, I could just see, you know, the energy drain from her face, and same with my three boys. And it was so clear that for them, picturing going forward with our grandkids and everybody without me, it was pretty powerfully negative at that point. So I just said, okay, that's it. I'm going to do everything I can to fight this thing and go at it.
Welcome to Imposters, the show where I talk to world-class execs, athletes, and entertainers about their personal challenges and how overcoming those challenges has shaped their careers and lives for the better. I'm your host, Alex Lieberman, co-founder and executive chairman of Morning Brew. My guest today is Jim Weber. Jim has been the CEO of Brooks Running Company for 21 years and is responsible for taking the company from near bankruptcy when he joined in 2001 to its current place, generating over $1 billion in revenue per year. Through his bold and innovative thinking, Jim took Brooks from being a mediocre shoe brand with a wide range of products to being a market leader in running shoes and apparel. Last year, Brooks beat out both Nike and Adidas for the top spot in the adult running shoes market in the US. But we also talk about an even more gargantuan challenge that Jim overcame. In 2017, Jim was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, something that not only threatened his life, but also didn't let the man who made running profitable run anymore himself. We get into all of that today and talk about his new memoir, Running with Purpose. My full conversation with Jim Weber right after this quick break.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Jim Weber, thank you so much for being on Imposters today.
Appreciate it, Alex. This will be a fun conversation.
You know, the arc of the conversation that I'm thinking is the only arc that you know, which is the Brooks story when you took over the business in 2001, what it was like to lead the business through the Great Recession, and then in the pandemic, how you adjusted, obviously, your experience with the cancer diagnosis. But I want to start earlier in life because I think in so many ways, at least the way you describe yourself today is informed by your childhood experience. So can you start by getting into what Jim's childhood was like?
I would say that I was kind of a lost kid, you know, a big family, number four of six kids, all in 8 years. So the house was chaotic. I didn't have a great relationship with my dad. I was kind of scared of him. He had alcohol issues and it was just chaotic. And I just felt, wow, you know, what's happening here? And by the time I got to age 10, it was clear that everyone's house wasn't as chaotic as mine. As I had friends and I went to their houses and the like, and for whatever reason, I just reacted differently. I think my siblings, I was mentally independent, literally in fourth or fifth grade. And I just decided I wanted to go some places. I wanted to be good at something. And so I put all I had into hockey. I wrote a seventh grade paper. I wanted to be an NHL player. But there was a backup plan because my favorite hockey player had one in business. So the second career I put down was to be a president of a company. I went with a vengeance off of that second choice of being a president of a company. It just is just something I decided I wanted to do. So I really, you know, got focused on that and built a path to do that. And it's interesting because, you know, we're all insecure. We'll dive into this a little bit, Alex, but I knew to be good at something, I was going to really have to focus on it, you know, and it goes to the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing. I really believe that. And I did it with hockey, but then I did it with leadership and in business. And so the early going, I was pretty hardwired and pretty focused on developing myself into a leader and with a focus on business.
Love the summation. Two questions just to go deeper here is, you said you didn't have the best relationship with your dad. Tell me why.
You know, it was interesting. I only learned later in life when we finally had some good conversations more or less one-on-one with my mom and dad and I at dinner, he didn't like being in a small family business. He had inherited a family business that was a bowling alley, tavern, restaurant. And so he was arm's length away from alcohol every day, but he really didn't want to be there. He was a, you know, kind of a budding engineer and was in construction crews. He liked to build stuff. So I don't think he was ever happy there. And I think he struggled with it all the way through. And maybe he was even a little bit bitter because his father had died and he had to come into the business. But I just watched him and I knew that is not what I wanted to do. He didn't look happy. And it was really interesting. I had two sides of my family. My mother's side was sort of glass half full, very relational and relationship oriented, always engaging with people. And my dad's side was more stoic, maybe German, you know, just more internal processing. And I have some of both of that, but I just wanted to be glass half full. I wanted to, you know, create relationships with people and enjoy life along the way. So it was something that was so clear, that dichotomy to me, that attitude was a choice. And there was, you know, sort of two paths to be on. And I just decided I wanted to be in that glass half full path.
So you are 21 years into being the CEO of a running brand, but your relationship with running started way earlier than that. So give me just some context on when you got into running and why it became such an important activity for you.
Absolutely. So the hockey dream was interesting. My dad was 6'2", I'm 5'8", and I was sort of this size in ninth grade. When you look at the team pictures and the football team and the hockey team, I was in the back row and I was tall. And by senior year, I was in the front row sitting down. And so that didn't happen. And so running just showed itself when I quit playing competitive hockey. So in college, you know, it was the jogging boom. I was in college, I graduated in 82, and the jogging boom was just taking off. And there were several books written, including Bill Bowerman at Nike wrote one. And it just created a sport that had such a surge of participation behind it, because it wasn't about breaking the tape. There was no way I was going to break the tape in a race. But you could jump in. And so I started running in 3 to 5 days a week since the age of 20. And I ran the first inaugural Twin Cities Marathon, I think in 82. I'll say there was 8,000 people out there, Alex. And it was really fun. I mean, I'd been running, you know, again, daily or weekly, probably 20 some miles a week. I learned that the marathon is more than hard. It's the last 6 miles, the wall was real for me, but that was it. I loved it. And it became, you know, both fitness, a good sweat, staying fit, and for me, meditation. I almost always ran by myself, and it was a great time to process big questions.
So let's fast forward to Brooks, because I mean, it's so interesting. You've basically had three different careers, and Brooks being your most recent for the last 21 years. But tell us about how you ended up at Brooks and why, where you were in your career, it was the right time to take this position.
So I have had an interesting career, and it's been somewhat deliberate. I came out of college and I only got a couple offers, and they were both in commercial banking. So I became a banker. But that was a precursor to the MBA. And so I joined Brooks in April 2001 as its fourth president in 2 years. The company had some challenges, and I've often observed, you know, that you typically don't get hired coming in from the outside if everything's great. And so all of the businesses I ran were turnarounds and in a way repositionings of the brand and the businesses. And so Brooks was the fourth one that I'd done in about 11 years. And I was really excited about it because I saw a lot of opportunity in a great category.
And so you alluded to this, but just get specific for a second. What was the position of Brooks in 2001 when you took over the business? How were things looking? And specifically, even from like a cash or financial position perspective, what was the business looking like?
It was interesting, Alex, because in a lot of these situations, usually there's not one thing that you have to address. It was pretty broad-based at Brooks. And so first of all, the brand was 90 years old at the time. It's now about 107 years old. And it was a traditional athletic footwear and apparel brand, meaning it had products in almost every category, every sport, from running to walking to baseball cleats, you know, football cleats, basketball shoes, court shoes, and the like. And it had all the price points, good, better, best price points, from $30 shoes, family footwear, casual, all the way up to performance products for athletes. And that was the same playbook that Nike and Adidas and almost every other brand had. The problem was we were very small. We were about $60 million in revenue in those days. And, you know, we didn't have the marketing budgets. We didn't have the brand awareness. We didn't have the scale as a business to compete in all of those areas. And now couple that with a cash crisis, a lot of debt. We had been purchased by a private equity firm. The company began to not be profitable. They lost money for 3 or 4 years at that point. And, you know, so it was a challenging puzzle because we needed to find a place to win. And so by focusing on run in that first year, we generated a lot of cash by eliminating product lines and selling inventory. We created
50% of product lines, right?
So what we did is we got rid of everything that wasn't performance run, which was 50% of our product line, and about 45% of our sales, including our biggest customer, which was in family sporting goods. It was Big Five, and they're a fine retailer. We were positioned as a $30 shoe there. And so we decided to focus on the performance running shoes, which were $80 and up, had good margins. And it was a bumpy transition because no one in our industry had ever really done that before. But we were pretty confident it would work because we'd done the analysis on it.
So it's interesting, right? Because having now been running a business for 7 years, it's always interesting to see when we hire senior leaders at our company, you know, the first thing that they'll say is, you know, we want to sponge things up, understand what's going on. And the last thing we want to do is blow shit up. We don't want to blow shit up because people are going to start freaking out and be worried about their jobs.
Yeah.
It sounds like you did the exact opposite. It feels like you very much blew shit up when you started the company. So how were you able to maintain faith in people in the business while doing that?
Oh, it's such a great question, right? I think in turnarounds, you know, the first job is to survive. You have to survive. So we had real challenges with almost, you know, $40 million in debt, and we hadn't made money in 4 years. We had to generate cash. And so by eliminating those businesses, we actually created cash flow because we were able to get the cash out of the inventory. We were trading dollars on those $30 shoes. We weren't profitable. So I knew that it wouldn't hurt us and it would generate cash. But it wasn't conventional wisdom. Everybody in our industry said, you need three legs of the stool because they all have fashion cycles and basketball's down, but running's up. And then you need all the price points to reach all the customers. And in modern, you know, day with supply chains as they are, you could focus on one area and be successful. But nobody had ever done it. And so part of it is, you know, doing our homework. We'd done the work. I believed, you know, A, it was going to work. B, we didn't have that many options either, Alex. So, you know, but in the early days, I remember with our employees and our team and our investors and our banks and everyone, we had to gain their trust. So we had to show results. The first board meeting where we presented our turnaround plan with new numbers, the boards, I had like 10 things that we had to get done to secure the year and set ourselves up for the following year. And the board said, Jim, you can't do 10 things. You got to pick four. And I said, actually, you know, you don't understand. We have to do all 10 of these to get from here to there. And we did. We actually made money that year. And we generated $10 million in cash. So that secured our survival. But the key things we did, like really focusing on product development, the Adrenaline GTS, which is one of our top-selling shoes today, was really perfected and engineered for a really balanced ride and fit in that year, that turnaround year. So that started to really carry our brand for the next decade, and it grew the next year. So anyway, a lot of things were happening at that time. I was pretty confident we could get there, but we had to gain trust with everybody and show results, of course, too.
I just want to take a second here to appreciate Jim's outside the box thinking. To come into a business that has $40 million in debt on its books and decide to narrow your product offerings is somewhat counterintuitive, definitely bold, but it definitely worked. Jim also says that the development of their Adrenaline GTS running shoe saved the company. While ASICS had long dominated the market in the support category of running shoe, the development of Brooks' GTS helped earn runners trust in the Brooks brand. Jim also saw the opportunity in solely focusing on the sport of running. According to a 2020 report from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association, about 50 million Americans participate in some form of running. And race participation has grown more than 50% worldwide over the last decade. The most popular running apps also saw a dramatic increase in users during the pandemic. And whether you're a competitive runner or just a lifestyle runner, one thing is universal. You have to replace your shoes a lot.
I learned this kind of the hard way. I saw it at Pillsbury with consumables. You know, if you can build loyalty, you can sell them products every week, if not daily. And then on the sporting goods side, I learned it the hard way because I was in the water sports business and the snow sports business. Unless you have a bad accident, those products tend not to wear out. Equipment is durable. And in some areas, you can share equipment. And in golf, you go through a lot more golf balls than you do drivers, right? So by the time I got to Brooks, I could see that the most valuable customer in our sport is the frequent runner. Because at the time, and it's still true, Runner's World did surveys, and the people that were putting 20 miles a week in were buying 2.6 pairs a year. So that was clear. If we could earn that most discerning, kind of toughest customer and earn their trust, we have a shot at selling them 2 to 3 pairs of shoes a year. And many people run and stay active through their whole lives. So yeah, that was a big unlock for us because that's a hard customer to get, but that's what we've challenged ourselves for. So it's really about the second shoe, Alex. There's so many brands, there's so many products that runners have to choose from now more than ever. But there always has been. All the best brands in athletic, in outdoor, in fitness, everybody's in running, not to mention fashion brands. So, but we've challenged ourselves first and foremost to earn that frequent runner because you got to really solve for their run.
So just talking for a bit more about when you took over the business, cash position of the business was really tough, fair bit of debt on the books. Like you had to refocus the business, and you talk about really starting to focus on the running shoe and kind of all these other things were noise that you had to take out of the equation and build up the cash position for Brooks. Can you talk about anything else that you did at the time to accelerate growth in this specific niche for Brooks as you got focused, as well as kind of like, what was your style of leadership or kind of like the values by which you led that helped kind of the entire company understand where you and the business were going?
So, you know, the first thing we did, and this is still a huge advantage for us in the book, I talk about just the power of focus and owning a niche. So because we had literally burned the boats on everything else, we were only going to focus on performance running gear that was runnable and the promise inside our products that you may not run 20 miles, but if you do, the promise is, you know, this is what it's engineered for. So, you know, we were maniacal about that. And what it led to is a focus on runners. And of course, walkers are part of this world and all that. But we wanted to talk to runners and try to get trial of our products, get it on their foot, and then we'd have a shot at earning their trust. So all of our distribution and every penny of marketing from that day forward was focused on being in front of runners, reaching runners. And of course, now we're doing that digitally, but this is pre-e-commerce. The internet was just happening. And so we focused on the very best retailers in running, these specialty run shops that are in every community around the country and the world, frankly. And we wanted to be their number one brand. So very customer service oriented to service those retailers who service runners. And they're basically curators of the best running gear in the market. And then the other place runners shopped was sporting goods. And of course, online now, but we partnered with, you know, the best sporting goods players because people would go in to buy their kids soccer gear or football gear or what have you, and they'd pick up their, you know, their next pair of running shoes. So that distribution focus was critical. It was so interesting. You know, we'd introduce ourselves so often to people. Yeah, I'm with Brooks. Brooks? Who's Brooks? Do you run? No. Okay. Well, you wouldn't know us then because all of our marketing went exclusively to people that were running.
One other example of this, and this happened later in the journey, but I just find it interesting to kind of show the relentless focus on who your customer was, is the rock and roll marathons and races. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about for a second why it ended up being a really important partner for the brand after obviously the contract was up with their previous partner?
So that was an interesting time for us. 2009, 2010, the Great Recession was coming on, and you know, the barefoot phenomenon was influencing performance footwear and running and what people thought they should be running in. And when we saw, though, that people were going to run right through this recession, which was amazing. It was such an interesting time, Alex, for us, because running isn't recession proof, but wow, it had some resiliency. When the Great Recession hit, unemployment rates, I'll give you two examples in Europe, Spain and Italy, I think unemployment below the age of 30 was over 50%. And in those early months, though, we saw running just took off. Shoes were selling. So right at that time, we said, we got to do two things. You know, we got to take it to this game. We want to invest in R&D and product because of this whole barefoot phenomenon and some of the questions that were raised, and we did. And then we thought we had a very unique position. We had this incredible focus on performance product for runners, and then we had this run-happy brand position that was really focused on celebrating your run. It wasn't about just breaking the tape. It wasn't about Olympic gold. We have athletes that are pursuing that. But for every runner, we're celebrating your run. Even if it's your first 5K or your 20th marathon, it's about you and your run. So that positioning, which we have this mantra sort of run happy for that, is really unique. And we actually announced to the world right at that time that we thought that positioning was a $1 billion business. And in the next decade, we thought we could be a $1 billion brand. And we'd have to earn it through customers. But that's exactly where we were. We took our profits down. And the Rock and Roll Marathon Series at that time was just perfectly positioned for where Brooks was, because I can't recall the exact percentage, but something like 40% of their participants, and it was growing really fast, had never, ever run a race before. They were brand new into the sport. So we not only sponsored that series, but we activated it at their expo and on course and just made a lot of noise. I believe they were servicing something like 500,000 runners a year, and 200,000 of them had never run a race before. So it was just a great platform for us to introduce our brand to more runners.
Throughout his 21 years with Brooks, Jim has masterfully handled several enormous business challenges, from joining the company when it was unfocused and $40 million in debt, to leading the company to success amidst a recession and the barefoot running phenomenon that shook the entire running industry, to even managing not to fire any employees during the pandemic. It's safe to say that Jim is an incredible role model for any business leader. We're going to take a quick break here, but when we come back, Jim talks about his most important challenge yet, his battle with cancer. Stay with us. So I want to move to kind of your most recent challenge, and not a professional challenge, albeit a professional challenge in some ways, but also a personal challenge. If I remember correctly from reading, you know, this diagnosis came right after you were giving a keynote at your global sales meeting in Seattle, and Gabe Grunewald, who was invited to speak about her journey at that meeting, she had been fighting a rare form of cancer for the previous 8 years. And obviously the irony of that whole thing was the cancer was in your system and you just didn't know yet. I want you to just really try to paint a picture of what the experience was like where you were, where your family was, how you reacted to basically the doctor telling you, at least from my reading, that, oh, this does not look good. I am 99% sure that this is cancer.
So behind me, that poster you see, that's Gabe Grunewald, brave like Gabe. She is just an iconic competitor and athlete in our sport, and fought cancer bravely and finally lost the battle. And I had interviewed her, and then 30 days later, I finally had this test where the doctor saw it. And so my wife and I are sitting there because I had to be under anesthetic, so she was going to take me home. I could see it in his face, right? He was serious and he was shuffling around. I was the last patient there. And he kind of looked away as our eyes met. And finally, he came over and he was very direct. You need to find a surgeon. I'm 99% sure we'll do the biopsy, but this is cancer. and liquid diet, no more solid food, go to the grocery store, get the insurer, you know, you need to see those people next week. And so that weekend we had no plan, no information, and we all processed it. And I think I'd begun to process it, Alex, and just be a bit at peace, because I've had a great life. I really have. And I've accomplished so many things in my life, great family. So I would say, okay, I'm going to have to get a plan together and go at this. But for my wife, I could just see, you know, the energy drain from her face, and same with my three boys. And it was so clear that for them, picturing going forward with our grandkids and everybody without me, it was pretty powerfully negative at that point. So I just said, okay, that's it. I'm going to do everything I can to fight this thing and go at it. And so it was a very busy weekend, because we got through the family stuff and started to orient on how to hold this and process it. We were going to have a meeting the next week with our team of doctors on a plan. And that weekend, I actually called Warren Buffett, and I talked through my situation and got some great advice from him on how to handle it and manage it and communicate it. But, you know, I always do better if I have a plan. I don't sleep very well if I don't. So, you know, within a week we had a plan, and it was super helpful to me, because then we just had to start going through, you know, all the things that we had to do and beat this thing.
Just a quick note for listeners. That wasn't just a fancy name drop Jim made there. Berkshire Hathaway actually owns Brooks, and over the years that Jim has run the company, Warren Buffett has become something of a mentor to him. And as we'll talk about later in the interview, Warren was also an important source of support for Jim during his cancer treatment.
One of the lines you say in the book, it was right after you had received your diagnosis and your wife and your children had found out, and you said, "As I processed my situation, I knew I did not want to live in fear even for one day." Why is that?
Yeah, I think everybody's unique, right? And what you do know when you're faced with that kind of situation is the essence of your values and your sensibility and how you live life are going to come through. And for me, and I think it had to do with my upbringing, is I wanted to take in what was positive every day. I didn't want to live a day being bitter, of being sad and grieving about what I had to lose. I had a lot to lose, but I didn't want to be holding that every day. I wanted to focus on the things I could take in that day, relationships and positive experiences and my teammates at Brooks and my family and my grandkids, you know, not thinking about what I had to lose, not worrying about what might happen, because I couldn't control it. I was going to work the plan really diligently, but I couldn't control it. So yeah, Alex, I think that's become my choice and almost hardwired into me, because I don't want to be unhappy. I don't want to be bitter. Yeah. I don't want to be sad. I just don't think that's good for other people around me. You could lose a whole day by being in that mode. So yeah, that's how I came out and reacted to it. I just didn't want to live a day about and being sad about what I had to lose.
It's interesting, because as I kept reading, it seemed like actually one of your bigger fears was the fear of you not having your dream job anymore, which was as the CEO of Brooks. I wanted to tell me what your conversation with Warren Buffett was like when you told him about your diagnosis.
You know, it was really started from the beginning, and he had just great advice about being open about it and communicating it. I'm an all-in person at Brooks, so if I'm not there, and I was going to miss, right, with all of these treatments, I was going to miss a lot of work. I ended up being able to work through it, but not 8 hours a day, the fatigue and the like. So we talked a lot about that, communicating it. He suggested I look at how some other leaders had done it, including Jamie Dimon, who had cancer, and Warren had prostate cancer, I think, the year before. So he had a lot to share with me about how to manage through it. He had to prioritize health, because it was about getting healthy. And then I shared with him, because I don't own Brooks, I've been there a long time, that my biggest fear was I was literally going to have to take 6 months off. I didn't have a plan at that point to get healthy. And Brooks would, you know, for good reason, have to move on. And I'd be out of a job. and I wasn't ready to retire. And so I'm, you know, there's an adage out there, Alex, that says, don't be defined by your work. And I think there's some good wisdom in that statement. But I love my job and I love the team that I'm working with. I love to build, we're building a brand, and there's nothing like building a brand with a team. And you know, we're doing so well at Brooks. Yeah, I thought, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to beat this thing after 6 months, but Brooks will have moved on. And then what am I going to do? So yeah, he said, don't worry, Jim, Brooks will be there when you get back, get healthy. So it was huge support, huge.
And Jim was so fortunate to have such great support and understanding from Warren and his Brooks team, because Jim's treatment was not an easy one and would lead to some lasting physical harm to his body.
In the early going, the fatigue of chemo and radiation is immense. And I would go in for daily radiation treatments, 3 hours at night, weekly 6 hour infusions for chemo. And then, you know, after surgery, you're in the hospital for 11 days. It's a very serious surgery. If you sort of, you know, do a search on the worst 10 surgeries that you never want to get, I think this esophagectomy is one of them. Don't recommend it. And I actually had some complications on that. And so I had another major surgery 2 years later, and I had some damage to my diaphragm. So it affected my cardiovascular system. So, you know, the long-term outcome is my digestive system mostly works. Grateful for that, but it isn't what it used to be. And the same with my VO2 max is much lower now because my lung capacity has been compromised by some of the complications. But, you know, I can move, I can do treadmill intervals, I can walk around, I can do a lot of things. So you take what you get. That's the truth of life, Alex, and I have a lot. So
it's so interesting just hearing you talk in this way, because I don't know if we have very different life experiences, but it feels so, you know, reminiscent of me trying to be default positive at all times, you know, very different experience. But I remember, you know, after my dad passed away, you know, suddenly when he was 49 and I was a junior in college, I just thought about kind of all the opportunities this created, and people would be like, opportunities, what are you talking about? And from time to time, I'd ask myself, like, is this healthy or am I in denial? Am I in denial of these sad feelings or angry feelings? Or is this just, I'm allowing myself to live kind of in my circumstances? Have you thought about it all? Your emotional state in kind of the midst of cancer and after it, how much of it is denial of sadness, of not being able to do the things that you once did as a protective mechanism versus just you feel like this is the best way to live a happy life?
It's certainly both. Look, I've had real bouts of sadness. You know, yeah. I miss my 6 mile long runs. I really mean it. That was meditation therapy for me. I just love.
And you can't do that anymore?
No, I can't sustain a running heart rate. I can run, walk, but I just can't sustain a running heart rate. My left diaphragm is paralyzed. More information than anybody wants to know. So my lung capacity is maybe 60% of what it was. And it wasn't great before. So yeah, but that's just the reality of it. So I get sad at times when I see people go out and run. You know, I just miss it tremendously. And yet, you know, I have a lot. I really mean that. So that's what I try to focus on. And that was partly from my mother's side of the family too. They had health issues, but yet they were always positive and present for other people, present for you, you know, how are you doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that orientation that isn't just on yourself is really enjoyable when you're interacting with other people. And so that's where I challenge myself, is that life's too short. You know, you have to take in every day. It's a cliche, but I just think it's a better way to go through life, because you're going to have more fun and you're just going to be a more balanced, complete person.
Last question for you is, it's an odd one, but it's a story that stood out to me from the book. Can you talk about the gift that you got from Warren in the hospital?
Oh my gosh. So the hospital experience was literally, 8 days, and it's a progression of recovery, and you're doing walks and all this stuff, but you know, feeding tubes and all kinds of stuff. I'm not eating meals at that point. I think I had Jell-O on the fourth day. So its staff there is incredible, man. I had world-class care. So about the third day, I'm getting gifts and well wishes and cards from people. I got a package from Warren Buffett, and I open it up, and it's a 5-pound box of See's candy. I think, Warren, what are you thinking? I'm not going to eat solid food for a long time. What are you thinking? This box of See's candy, 5 pounds. So I opened the card and said, Jim, you're at a fabulous place. You've got great care, I'm sure. Put this out on the nurse's station and tell them if the great care continues, there's more where this came from. And of course, it's classic Warren. I put it out in the nurse's station, and everybody that came in, you know, that entire week was smiling at me and connecting in and checking in, and that candy went a long way. But it's just classic Warren. It actually made my week better. So how good of a gift was that from him? It was fabulous. It was really
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to finish with rapid fire questions. So these are going to be quick, one word to one sentence, and we're going to bang through them. First question, what is the number one lesson that Warren Buffett has taught you as a mentor?
Focus on the customer.
Second question, what is your number one tool for facing uncertainty or challenge in your life or work?
Situational awareness, process everything, get your windshield filled out with the best data and frames that you can to make a decision in face of ambiguity. Process
it. Love it.
Yeah.
What is something that motivates you that maybe you're not so proud of?
Ooh, fear. I was motivated by fear. Fear of failure. The first 30 or 40 years of my life, one of the reasons I wrote the book is to unpack why I am the way I am. I was running from failure. I did not want to fail. So running from, you know, fear of failure was big.
And last question for you, what is the most memorable run that you've ever had in your life?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. What's coming to me right now is trip to New York, first snow of the year. It's probably late November, an inch of powder in Central Park, and soft flakes falling, and it's dead quiet. Couldn't hear it. It was like 6 a.m.
What year was that, out of curiosity?
Oh my gosh, it was probably 15 years ago. I've had a couple runs like that in Minnesota. I had one in Salt Lake during a trade show. But I, you know, that quiet, soft snowfall. And the key is not too much, because then you can just let the normal stride. It was awesome.
Totally. Love it. Jim Weber, thank you so much for the time.
Alex, thanks for having me. Fun conversation.
There's no question that Jim's attitude and outlook on life has served him well. It's so apparent that his genuine love for the challenge of turning around a failing business and building an incredible team is the reason behind Brooks's success. And his penchant for making a plan and appreciating what he has seems to be what carried him through his cancer treatment. Now, the irony isn't lost on anyone that this man who has built a top-running company and who himself loved running for years can no longer take part in the sport. But as you heard in the interview, Jim doesn't dwell on that. And perhaps that's the exact key to his success. Now, Imposters listeners, we need your help. We would love to hear from you on how the conversations on Imposters have impacted your life. How does this show help you in your career or your personal life? Are there any particular guests or episodes that have stood out to you? And tell me the stuff that you haven't liked, where you want the show to get better. Our goal is simple. We want to make this as valuable as humanly possible and make the show worthy of your time. So shoot me an email at alex@morningbrew.com and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Imposters is a production of Morning Brew. Our senior producer is Vishnu Vallabhaneni, and Michaela Heck is our producer. Brian Henry is our executive producer, and AB Silver is our booking producer. Our sound engineers are Dan Bauza and Rosemary Minkler. Greg Jacobs is our video producer, and Sarah Singer is our VP of multimedia. Our theme song is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Original music in this episode is by Rosemary Minkler.